Good evening, everybody, back in Arkansas, and welcome to tonight's tele-town hall meeting. I'm Congressman Steve Womack. I represent Arkansas's 3rd Congressional District, and pursuant to the election of November the 5th, 2024, I've been granted another We'll talk a little bit up front about what's going on in Congress right now, and then we'll open it up for questions. But I do want to acknowledge that because this is a very busy holiday season, you've honored me tonight by joining our conversation, and sure hope I can talk with as many of you as possible. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't recognize the fact that today we have another tragedy in our country. We had a shooting up at this Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, Wisconsin, and our thoughts and our prayers are with the families affected up there, the first responders, and all of the people associated with that school and that city. These kinds of incidents can happen really and do happen anywhere in our country. And so our hearts are pretty heavy tonight for the people in Madison here during the holiday season. I want to start by talking a little bit about the current state of affairs. You know, we have the government funded through Friday of this week, the 20th, and that was a continuing resolution passed in late September when it became obvious that we didn't have our budget and appropriations work completed sufficiently to be able to start the fiscal year, October 1, with a budget. So we punted that issue until the 20th of December because we were frankly running out of time. And here we are again, deja vu all over again. We're running out of time again, and we don't have FY25 appropriations finished to the degree that we could pass a full-year appropriation bill. So it's going to be necessary, and this was a decision made by our leadership, to continue funding at the previous levels through about the middle of March. Now, I'm a little vague on some of this for a reason. We don't have the text yet of the legislation that we will be voting on this week that will fund the government after Friday. There are some challenges with it. Notably, more recently, the farm community weighed in on the disaster supplemental. There was no money in there for the farmers and ranchers that have been hit hard by low commodity prices and other issues, input factors that impact our farming community. And, you know, our farmers in America feed and clothe much of our nation and the world, and this is a very critical time for our farm community because they're going to their banks right now in anticipation of the planting season that is going to happen real soon, and they're going for their loans and their cash flow and this sort of thing, and there's some uncertainty in this arena. So that bubbled up over the last couple of days, and that's complicated matters. So Speaker Johnson, our team, and the team in the Senate are working pretty closely, I think, with the President-elect's transition team, try to figure out what it is we can get done that can garner enough votes so that we don't have a stoppage in government functions here at the end of this week. So that's what we're dealing with right now. There's some very important stuff in this FY25 legislation that I'm anxious to see us complete. Certainly if this CR goes to mid-March, I would like to believe that we can finish the FY25 bills, get those signed into law for the balance of the fiscal year, because of so many things in that bill that benefit my district, not the least of which is Ebbing Air Force Base down at Fort Smith, which is going to be the training center for the F-35 FMS mission down in Fort Smith. There's a 14.5% pay raise for junior enlisted that's in the legislation. We have money set aside in the FY25 bill for Highway 412 going east of I-49, which connects it down to 265, money to accelerate the construction of that project, and a lot of other smaller projects in the FY25 legislation that benefit our local community. So we're very serious about finishing our work, but we need a little bit more time, and that's why the CR is going to be so important. Those of you that have joined the call tonight, just an administrative note for you. There are two numbers you can hit on your phone. One, if you want to ask a question tonight, it's *3. Just hit the star button, then 3, and that will put you in the queue for us to be able to talk about whatever happens to be on your mind. And then if you press *6, it will link you to the opportunity to sign up for my weekly newsletter that comes out every Friday afternoon. So if you want to receive that newsletter via email, hit *6. Don't ask a question tonight. It's *3. So the election is come and gone. We've unified the government. January 3rd, the 119th Congress will be sworn in. I'll be one of those people here that day. January 20th, President-elect Trump will become the 47th president of the United States, having already served as the 45th president. And then hopefully within the next several months, we'll execute the plan of work established by the Trump administration and the unified Congress, the Republicans in the House and the Senate. Very thin margins, and I want to manage your expectations here tonight. Be patient with us, because when we roll into the next Congress, having lost one member, a net loss of one member in this last election, the House will have the narrowest majority, I think, that it's certainly in contemporary history, but maybe ever. And then the Senate, as you know, will have a three-seat majority, 53-47, but 53 does not equal 60, so it is not filibuster-proof. So as you can tell, we're still going to have thin margins and a very difficult time of imposing the complete package on our country. But in the meantime, I think we're going to have the answers to a lot of very difficult questions that still face our country, not the least of which has been inflation or border security or national security and the like. So with that said, *3 if you want to ask a question, *6 if you want to sign up for our newsletter. So let's get right to it. I've got my staff here that are manning the phones in my office tonight, and I'm grateful to them for the yeoman's work that they do for the 3rd District of Arkansas, and of course we've got our telephone coordinators that are here with us tonight as well. All right, so Nick Runkle of my legislative team is standing by. We have an online submission from Doug from Bella Vista asking, if Congress's main job is funding the government on time, why do they fail to accomplish this mission every single year? Boy, Doug, I could not agree with your question more. The way it's designed is for the president to submit a budget in February, and then both the House and the Senate enact budget resolutions, and then combine the two, because they'll be different, and do a joint budget resolution, from which we establish what we call the top-line numbers for discretionary spending. Top-line, the technical term is a 302A, and that means this is the amount of money that we're going to have this year. Article 1 responsibility. Notice I said discretionary spending, because not included in this annual appropriations process is what we call mandatory spending or autopilot spending or entitlement spending. You can pick the term that you want to use, but that's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and of course paying the interest on our debt and a handful of other programs, some retirement in nature. So 70% of this budget is on autopilot. That's mandatory spending. And we're only dealing with less than 30% of the budget from an appropriation standpoint. And the reason we can't get it done is because, one, in part because we have very thin margins, and there are strong opinions one way or the other about different subjects. You know, how much to spend on national defense, how much not to spend on national defense. The Republicans have been known for a long time to be the champions of national security, and Democrats, on the other hand, have wanted what they call dollar for dollar. If you're going to spend it on national security, then they're going to want dollar for dollar on the programs of interest to them, and they cover a big front, you know, similar to the entitlement programs. But at the end of the day, we just run ourselves out of time. So we don't do. And then by the time you look up, if you have a top line number, then you don't have time to complete the appropriations process before the 1st of October, which means you need to continue the funding from the previous year into the next appropriation cycle or into the next fiscal year. That's called a CR, which is precisely what we're on right now. So we're always operating behind, and that's just the function of the modern day Congress. I have in a joint in the budget process, Joint Select Committee, back in 2018, advocated for a two-year budget, and I continue to advocate for a two-year budget, so we can do one budget resolution, kick out our top-line numbers from that resolution that would cover the next 2 years, and then give Congress the time to be able to spend, to enact appropriation language in year one, and then move smartly into year two and avoid this debacle called a continuing resolution. The only other alternative besides the government shutdown is to just put it all into one big package, and we've done that before. That's called a big omnibus package, and most people don't like that as well. So we're doing the best we can, but in divided government, this is kind of the new norm for the present-day Congress. And I know we want to get beyond this, and I will do everything I can to help us move from that.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
This is Mark Pryor, and I'm a retired postal employee in Fayetteville for 30 years, and I have moved out from Fayetteville to Beaver Lake up by Eureka Springs. And first of all, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
And congratulations on the recent election win.
Thank you.
I'm disabled from the injury at the post office after I was working there for many years. It went on to where it was so bad I had to have surgery on my leg. And so I've applied 2 years ago, to our Army Corps of Engineers in Rogers, Arkansas, to have steps put in down to my dock to a certain height of the water, down to what's called 1120, down to from 1130 down to 1120. And as we know, our lake goes up. A lot of people in Northwest Arkansas know our lake goes up and down. Recently, it was at 1112, and it's right now at 1117. I've asked for these steps for my disability, and the Corps of Engineers and Rogers have been great people to work for. Well, about last April, they approved my steps, and they even told me, Mark, go ahead and buy your concrete rocks, tell me how I need to put them in, and so I'm getting all ready, and I've bought my rocks and everything and done everything they told me, and then they said, we have to get Little Rock to approve it. Little Rock's had it in their hands since April. Now, this is a two-year thing. I'm afraid I'm going to die before I get my steps put in. But I was wondering, is there any way we can help the Corps of Engineers as far as either maybe they need more help, people or something to help them where they can move along their pay? I know post office was slow, but I've never seen anything take this long.
Well, so Mark, I need to move along. I'm going to tell you right now, before you hang up, I'm going to give you a name and a phone number, and tomorrow I would like for you to call my office in Rogers and ask for Kyle Weaver. And the number of that office is 479 464-0446. I'll run over that again here in just a second. But Kyle Weaver is kind of my core expert. I can pretty confidently tell you that the issues we're talking about are not necessarily funding related, like a lack of manpower or resource issues. They have a lot more to do, in my strong opinion, with the Corps being a heavily bureaucratic organization. And it takes some special patience and talent to be able to work within that organization to get things done like what you're talking about. So it sounds to me like the local office, the Beaver Lake office, has worked very closely with you. But I think if we're going to move this off the dime here, I want you to call Kyle Weaver tomorrow at 479-464-0446, and let's open what we call casework on this issue. Kyle can be your... I hope that...
Thanks.
Are you still there, Mark?
Cut out there for a second. I got Kyle Weaver's name and number, and I'll
okay.
give him a call in the morning, sir.
You do that, and then close the loop with me. Kyle probably will anyway, but let us know how it goes, okay? That's what we're here for.
Thank you so much.
All right, we got Lesson from Bentonville, National Commission on Defense Strategy, I think is the subject here. Lesson, are you there?
Been here. Nice to chat with you again, sir.
Thank you.
So the first off, a shout out to Jessica Burkett, who you're just a fellow who calls me back from time to time. I really appreciate the call she does. Makes me feel heard. I appreciate that. And thank you for your strong support for Ukraine. But the commission report back in July said Congress should pass a supplemental appropriation immediately to start investing in our, increasing our defense industrial base. Support U.S. allies at war and stuff, et cetera. And in the report, and they called for 3-5% real growth in our defense budget. And actually, that's from the previous commission report, based on the 2018 commission report. So they just echoed that, and they said we didn't do that, not consistently, and we're basically at a deficit. What are your thoughts? And what I noticed in the language is that Congress should pass a supplemental appropriation immediately. Does that mean that in your capacity on the Defense Subcommittee for Defense, appropriations, that's in your area where you could actually help push a supplemental for increasing our defense spending?
Yeah, it is. And just stay on the line in case you got a follow-up on this, and I'll be happy to talk a little bit about it. Well, first of all, let's all agree that this is a very unstable world we live in right now. And there are a lot of difficulties around the globe. I mean, you don't have to look much further than Eastern Europe or the Middle East or the saber rattling in the South China Sea or Iran, violent extremist organizations and the like. There are just a lot of challenges around the globe. National security is quite important to the well-being of all Americans. And it's a constitutional imperative because the Constitution itself says provide for the common defense. The question that we come up with from time to time is how much do we spend on national defense? Now, I have my opinions about how we should fashion a defense budget, and then there are others, budget hawks and otherwise, that have a different approach on it. My thought is we need to fund national defense based on what we consider to be the perceived or real threats facing the sovereignty of the United States of America and our allies and partners, at whatever that amount should be. And we can argue all day long about numbers, but too many times we focus on, well, we've only got this much money to spend, so let's do what we can with it. In the case of a CR, then you're asking about a supplemental, and I agree that a supplemental is probably going to be necessary. We are doing a CR right now that funds national defense at levels from over a year ago. Well, the world has changed since over a year ago, and the needs of our military have changed since over a year ago. And when you do a continuing resolution, you're simply saying we're going to freeze spending at a certain level. And, oh, by the way, you can't do what we call new starts. You can't put resources behind new programs. And we've got lots of weapon development programs that need to be mature, that are going to need resources behind them, that we just can't simply start, because that's one of the rules of the CR, is that you base it on previous authorization and you can't do new starts. So I'm a big believer that, and I've talked to Senator Roger Wicker from the Senate side this past week, and I agree that what we're funding defense at is just inadequate right now. But we've got to get a bill out this week, or we would see the wheels of Congress or the wheels of the federal government grind to a halt right here at a terrible time of year. And that creates vulnerabilities that only exacerbate the situation. So we're going to have a robust discussion beginning in January, when the new Congress is seated, about just what we should be spending on national defense. And then you've got a Dutch effort going on right now that's going to try to cut spending. And where they look in national security, in the Pentagon spending, is going to be of interest. But we're going to need a supplemental of some type. It's just that there are too many competing things going on right now, not the least of which is disaster funding, that are competing for the attention of Congress as we close out this calendar year. So we'll be standing by, ready to go to work. And you're right, I'm a defense appropriator, and this is right in our arena. And we have written our bills in 25 that we're still struggling to get across the finish line. We've written those bills to the FRA number. The Senate wrote to a much higher number, and we'll have to deconflict that if we're going to get an FY25 appropriation bill done, say, between now and the end of the next CR. But I appreciate the call. It's vital to the safety and security of America, vital to our economy, and certainly vital to the men and women who voluntarily support and defend the Constitution of the United States. All right, let's go to the next caller. I think we've got Becky from Farmington. Are you there, Becky?
Yes, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Pretty good. And thank you for taking my call. My dad served in World War II, invasion of Normandy, Omaha Beach, and then he was 37 years in the Arkansas State Police. Of course,
he's
passed away now. But, of course, I am all for giving more money for defense. I'm all for getting our borders closed, getting jobs back to the citizens. You know, we're the most, we're growing up here so fast. Farmington and Perry Grove have over 900 houses coming in. We don't have the infrastructure over here. It would create jobs if we could have another bypass around Prairie Grove and Farmington. And also, it would help people to get on and off. I mean, this is getting really insane over here. And they don't seem to be doing anything about it. And, you know, if you could make a bypass that would get us up to, like, the Rogers area or to the airport, it would, you know, create jobs to help people, help farmers. And we have a lot of farmers over here, as you know. And I was wondering if there's anything you could do about that.
All right. Well, first of all, because you're from Farmington, let me give a shout-out to Tommy Tice and the Farmington Cardinals. Now, they didn't end the season the way they wanted to. They ran into a very tough Parkview football team there in the finals. But Tommy and those Cardinals had a magical season this year and won their conference and ended up playing for the state championship. Tommy won his 300th game during the course of that season, and I'm very, very proud of them. Also very proud of Lane Taylor. Lane plays for UCA now. He's a basketball player, and he played against Arkansas last Saturday, and I think he got 13 or 15 points. But I consider a true freshman. And he's doing great things down there. So a shout out to Farmington. All right, Becky. So here's the deal: infrastructure in growth areas is we're always going to be playing from behind because it's just very difficult to get the proper resources in place and then see that this infrastructure is built in time to accommodate a growing population. And Northwest Arkansas has just grown exponentially. And they say in the next couple of decades, we're going to be pushing 1 million people in the Benton and Washington County area. So we're going to be playing from behind, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying every day to find the opportunity to get resources behind projects. That's why I've worked very hard in my subcommittee chairmanship on transportation to get this money coming back into Arkansas. For many years, Arkansas was treated like a flyover state. It just didn't get the money out of the federal government that I thought it deserved. But we're changing that now, and we're going to be even doing more when the next Congress convenes. But here's a couple of examples I'll give you. I've got two bridge projects for Farmington in the next bill, the FY25 appropriation bill, the one that we continue to work on, that's not finished, that we hope to get signed into law sometime in the spring. $6.5 million I put in that T-HUD bill to build two very important bridges along Double Springs Road. That will help. It's not the answer to all of our problems, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. There are other infrastructure needs in the area. You mentioned a bypass from Farmington, you know, kind of up into Benton County. I would call that, I term it the Western Beltway. That's what some people characterize it. We don't have a location for it yet, but there is going to be a need for north-south traffic to be able to move off of I-49 and somewhere on the western side of Benton and Washington County. We've got the east-west corridor that's greatly improving over time with 412. We've already done the improvements to I-49. We've got a project working right now from I-49 going out to the regional airport, National Airport, XNA. And then I watched the flyover today, and it's somewhere online, that shows the progress being made between I-49 down to Taneytown for that stretch of 412. So we've got things going. We're going to do more, but it's going to take us a while. And all of this stuff is going to be pretty doggone expensive. But I'm leading the Transportation and Housing and Urban Development Subcommittee and Appropriations, and I'm going to be doing everything I can to bring as much of this money back to my district because I know when we build infrastructure in Northwest Arkansas, it's not just a comfort issue for us, a convenience issue. It is absolutely contributing to a very healthy economy, and our economy is driving a lot of the train in the great state of Arkansas. But I do appreciate your call tonight on that subject. We're nearing 7:30 local time in Arkansas. Let me say Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy met with House Republicans this past week to discuss their plans to lead DOGE. Now, that's an acronym for Department of Government Efficiency, through three major kinds of reform. Regulatory rescissions, that's pulling back some of these regulatory burdens. Administrative reductions, that's more administrative or executive branch level stuff. And cost savings, read cuts to some program. I want to hear from you. So do you support the DOGE effort? Do you support what Vivek and Elon are trying to do for President-elect Trump? This is our poll question for the night. And so if you agree with DOGE, I want you to press 1, and your vote will be recorded. And if you don't agree with the DOGE effort, press 2 for no. So 1 for yes, 2 for no. That's our poll question for tonight. All right, let's go to, is it Lowell? Lowell from Rogers. Are you there? Hello?
Hello. Hello.
Yes, sir.
You there?
Yes, I am. Yes,
94-year-old individual with Social Security. My
question. God bless you.
You know, yeah, he does every day. You've got two things you can do to strengthen Social Security, and neither one of them hurt the little guy. In fact, we'll even put it to the big guy. One is start means testing who gets Social Security. I don't know why Elon Musk needs to have a increase in his retirement. It isn't even a figure that he would worry about. Second of all, take the cap off Social Security so that you pay Social Security on your income, period, and see how that happens. One other thing that I would like to say is, at my age, when I didn't have my work done, I worked 5 days a week and didn't take a vacation. I think that's a pretty good thing for Congress to think about.
Okay, I got it, Lowell. Thank you. I'll comment on both of those subjects, and I appreciate your call tonight. First of all, let's take the second part of it first, the cap. He's talking about trying to save Social Security. Social Security Trust Fund runs out of money, and there won't be enough benefits coming in to pay the current benefits by, what is it, Nick, 2033, 2034, somewhere in that, it's 2030s, early 2030s, which is, if you think about it, it's not very far away. I mean, here we are at 2024, almost 2025, so 8-9 years from now, we're not going to have enough money coming in from the people that are paying into the program to be able to cover all the benefits. So something's going to have to happen. Congress will deal with it, but if the budget and appropriations is any indication as to how Congress is going to deal with it, you know we're going to wait to the last minute. And then the things that we'll have to do will be very draconian in nature. What I've advocated all along is we know we've got a problem. We can see the train wreck coming. I think it's always better to do something now and kind of lessen that impact rather than wait for the last minute where you got to do something really big that's going to be politically difficult. Now, you mentioned two specific things, and I want to talk about both of them. You're talking about means testing. Well, means testing to most people rolls off the tongue pretty easy, but how do you tell somebody that's paid into Social Security all their life that they shouldn't be able to draw from it? It's a fairness question. Now, I'm with you. I believe that people worth tens of millions or billions of dollars aren't going to miss that couple of $1,000 Social Security check every month. It's not going to impact their life any. But what ends up happening is if you don't have enough money to pay the benefits to the current retirees, those that are dependent on Social Security, it does affect them. So means testing is problematic from a standpoint of what is fair. And I think we could all agree that it's very easy to say that, you know, wealthy people, wherever you draw that line, don't need it. And means testing is probably going to have to be one of the things that we look at. You talked about the cap on how much you pay into Social Security. Right now, the cap this year is $160,000. Once you make $160,000, you no longer pay into Social Security for that given year. It starts over at the beginning of the next year. And I have advocated for a long time that cap needs to go higher. And it is incrementally going higher right now, but I think it ought to go it ought to be at least at the level of what a member of Congress makes, because that's the body that can change it. But I think there is a case to be made for how we should pay into Social Security on W-2 income all the way up to, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 a year, maybe even more than that. But that will infuse some resources into the program that will buy us a little bit more time. But there's also going to have to be some restructuring that goes into this thing. And here's why. About 10,000 people a day are aging into the program. And these folks are, and this is a good news thing, they're living a lot longer than when those programs were created back in the 1930s. And so if the lifespan for the average American person was, say, 69 or 70 back in the 1930s and 40s, and today you pick up tomorrow's paper, and I'll bet you a dollar to a donut that you're going to have more people in the obituary column that are over 80 years of age than younger than 80. And so, therefore, they're going to be in the programs a lot longer. So restructuring that program is probably going to be in order. And know this, Congress is going to fix the problem. The question is, when will Congress realize that we have a severe problem? And I am hopeful in this next administration that we can take a look at the programs that we call benefits to the American people, entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, however you want to term it. We need to be able to look at those programs and try to figure out how can we make them sustainable over the long term, or what changes should we make and to what age groups, so that there will be a program that they will pay into, that they will benefit from in the future. I can tell you right now, Medicare, as we know it, will not be the program of record for, say, the staff members that are working here tonight for me that are in their 20s. Just it's mathematically, actuarially, not going to be possible. So, but Congress is the final arbiter in it, and I am hopeful that this DOGE effort, that President Trump, that the Congress will figure out some way to deal with this program. Personally, I think there should be a kind of a debt commission established, and I would also favor a primetime fiscal State of the Union address to the Congress by the Comptroller General of the U.S. We need to know what this problem really looks like if we're ever going to have a chance to fix it. Because right now, as long as, you know, we're able to borrow money, it seems like this thing just doesn't ever come to an end. So I'm like you. I think we ought to try that. Now, let's say one more thing, and I'll take the next call. In 2018, when I was the chairman of the House Budget Committee, my 2019 budget had an increase in the retirement age from 65 to 67 to equalize it with Social Security. We're talking about Medicare now. And I got a lot of pushback on that. That budget never made it to the floor. But I do think we need to have the conversation about age of eligibility, the caps on income, means testing, even potentially increases in the FICA charges, if that's what it's going to take. But we're going to have to fix the problem, because too many people rely on those programs. All right, what's next? We got Vicki from Bella Vista, I think.
My question is, can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am, I sure can.
Okay. I am from Rogers, Arkansas, and I graduated from there. I winter in Vincent, Arizona, which is just outside of Tucson. And my question is about the illegals coming into our country, into Arkansas. And do we know how many illegals are in our northwest Arkansas area right now?
Yeah, a bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, we don't know the number, but I think it's safe to say that we have our share, maybe more than our share, of people who are undocumented in for whatever reason. I mean, it may not be that they all snuck into the country. Some of them came here on visas and just kept staying beyond the expiration of the visa. But we do have an undocumented problem in our area for doggone sure.
Right. And I know that we have a lot of factories that hire a lot of illegals in Northwest Arkansas. And is there, and I know that, you know, they're probably needed, but, and I'm not sure what the answer is. But there seems like there ought to be a way that they could come here legally. You know, the place that we RV here in Vinson, Border Patrol is running the highways like crazy, stopping the illegals. I don't know. I know it's not that bad, you know, in Northwest Arkansas, but I think something has to happen before it gets out of control. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, ma'am. Do I? Do I? Ma'am. Yeah, I do. And so let me make a couple of comments about it. And then if you got additional questions, I'll take those. One, it goes back to the nation's resolve. If America wants something bad enough, it will happen. But America, I think, voted for in November of 2024 was border security. Now, they voted for other things, don't get me wrong. I mean, we're not happy with inflation, and there are issues with national security and other issues. But clearly, and I know this firsthand because when I ran for office, a good politician is going to poll his people. You know, he's going to commission polls that's going to show what the current issues are, and that's how you'll fashion your campaign. And we did ours about border security. Clearly, people are concerned about the porous border. I've seen it firsthand. I've been down there many times. So a couple of things. One, back in 2007, and I don't know how long you've been how long you've been in Rogers, but when I was mayor in Rogers in 2007, I think I was the fifth mayor in the country to establish a 287G program in Rogers because I saw this issue 17 years ago. Firsthand. In fact, I saw it 20-plus years ago. But in 2007, we had the opportunity to send some of our police force to Boston for training under the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Section 287G. And I brought back officers that did immigration enforcement with the feds right there in Rogers, Arkansas. I think over time we removed about 3,000 people. From Northwest Arkansas based on that program. Wasn't popular to some people. I got criticized for it, got written up about it, but we had a very, very clear-eyed picture of what was happening if you don't do something about illegal immigration. So we took that action. But since then, I've supported building the wall. It's not the panacea for all issues immigration-wise. But it fits into what I consider to be defense in depth. So the wall, other means, better border security, border agents, all of the things that would go into establishing a defense in depth on border security, I think would help. Then there's a policy piece to this thing. The policies that we had under Donald Trump, number 45, was remain in Mexico. And if you're seeking asylum, you there are prohibitions for you to just be turned loose in our country. And that if you were trying to get into this country, you stayed in the country of origin before you were allowed to enter. Those are the kinds of policies that I think when you tear those policies down, when you rescind those, then it's come one, come all. And I think that's what we have been saddled with over the last 4 years under the Biden administration. So I voted for H.R. 2. It's the most sweeping border security legislation out there. We haven't been able to get it enacted into law because of divided government, but I think there are pieces of H.R. 2, more Border Patrol agents, remain in Mexico policy, wall spending, technological spending. Those are the kinds of things that H.R. 2 does. Now, you mentioned our corporations. And yeah, they need workers. But we need a system of immigration that allows individuals, fully vetted, to be able to come into our country and be able to work. Guest worker visa-type programs. But if you've got an open border, then those programs don't work. Because people are going to sneak into the country anyway. Because it's easier. So I think first thing we got to do is establish border security and then go to these policies, make sure that we're adequately funding CDP and that they're not just babysitting people in camps, that they're actually doing border security so that the corporations out here can have some means of assurance or confidence that the people coming into their HR office looking for a job, that the documents that they have would be documents that are pretty certain to be legit. Right now, I don't think it's that way. But we're going to continue working on it. Let's give this next Congress and the President-elect an opportunity to do what we said we would do. All right, here are the poll results. Thank you for participating. 85% believe in the DOGE effort. 15% do not support it. So by an overwhelming margin, the people in Arkansas 3, at least those tuned in tonight, support the DOGE effort. All right, David from Springdale, you're next.
Hi, sir. Can you hear me?
I can hear you well.
I have a couple questions. One, I know the House has a slim majority, but do you, you know, and you don't have to say the names, but do you know as a body who may be the wild cards that might not support Trump's policies? And another aspect of the question I'd like to ask is when the person called, I think they were 95 years old, they said they were talking about a means testing and talking about Vivek Ramaswamy and not needing Social Security. My thinking on that is, and I've worked since I'm 12 years old, and I fell off a building and I broke 15 bones and I can't work anymore. So I have, I'm on a fixed income. My question or my thoughts on that are, I feel like if you've paid into Social Security, then you deserve, you know, the benefit. What I don't understand, and maybe you can help me with this, is that I'm aware, and I don't know if it's that way anymore, but I'm aware of certain, you know, programs that would take money from Social Security benefits to maybe pay for surgeries for something or for that money is being taken from the Social Security benefits to fund other things. And if you also would know how many people collect Social Security benefits that have never paid into it. And, you know, that would be the start right there is to, if you haven't paid into it, I'm not sure why you would get benefits from it. And one last thing. If somehow we can always find money, billions and billions of dollars for the Ukraine war, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to find the billions and maybe it's $1 trillion for funding, you know, Social Security. Just some thoughts, and hopefully you have some ideas on that. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, look, I appreciate it, and you've opened up a couple of subject areas that would take a lot longer than the time we have left to be able to go into it. The first question you ask is, who in our, look, we're going to have, I think when we open camp on January 3rd, Republicans will control about 220 seats. We need 218 for anything to do on our own. Well, Matt Gaetz is already gone, so they take that to 219. Elise Stefanik and Michael Waltz are going to the administration, so that's two more. So we're going to be down around 217, 218, and it's going to be that way until we have special elections to fill the vacancies on Gaetz, Stefanik, and Waltz. And then on any given day, you know, life happens to people. You know, we're going to – somebody may die. Somebody's going to get hurt. You know, unforeseen circumstances. I think tonight – Nick, I don't know how many people didn't vote tonight. We had votes tonight. There was like 40 or so people that weren't even here voting. So attendance is going to be an issue. The people who won't support on the Republican side, now, I think it's safe to say that very few Democrats are going to support what the president-elect is going to do. But on the Republican side, it depends on what the issue is. If it's a budget issue, there's about 15 or 20 people that are going to be hardcore budgeteers. And you know who they are, the Chip Roys and of the world, Scott Perry, those kind of guys, Ralph Norman. These are all people I know, colleagues of mine, but they're very, very serious budget hawks. And then on the other side, you've got deficit people, or not deficit people, but you got defense people. So Mike Rogers and the House Armed Services Committee, those folks want to spend more money on defense. So you've got a natural built-in conflict already brewing within your party between how much you can spend or how much you shouldn't spend. So we're going to continue to have those conflicts. So depending on what the subject is, will depend on who the friendly forces are and who's going to be pushing back. One more issue. We're going to do a big tax bill sometime this year, next year, in the next Congress. And I can assure you now that the New York guys, Republicans, you know, the Nick LaLotas of the world and the Mike Lawlers of the world, those guys are going to be holding out for fixing the state and local tax deduction piece in that 2017 bill. So they're going to be all over that. And there's going to be a bunch of budget hawks that aren't going to like that. So we're going to have some conflicts, and it's going to be a testy environment here for a few months. So I just want to manage everyone's expectation. Now, on means testing, we've already covered that about Social Security. The question is going to be, if you paid into it, should you be able to collect it? Or should the federal government be able to say, well, you shouldn't be able to? So, I mean, that's a debate that we're going to have. As for Ukraine funding, look, I feel a little differently about that. Imagine what life would be like, certainly in Europe, but could be globally, if America hadn't stood up to the plate in the 1930s and 40s. See, American leadership is always going to be necessary in a complicated world. And if you're going to have the ability to influence outcomes with allies and partners, read NATO, or if you're going to have trade relationships that are important, and we do a lot of trade with Europe, we do a lot of trade with, you know, the Asia-Pacific region, those kinds of things. If you're going to have those, then it's only going to happen if you've got some means of security in those areas. And America leads on that front, and America has always led on that front. And so I am one that believes that we need to be helping sovereign nations protect their sovereignty. That's why I support helping Ukraine, because I don't want Vladimir Putin to have a blank check in Eastern Europe, control that area, and then turn his attention on NATO, because it could really destabilize the world to an extent that we would regret not participating. The last thing I want to say about that, about foreign aid in general, is just remember this. Where we unplug, where we pull back our investments, China is going to plug in. And we need to be careful of that. China, hear me out, China is our pacing threat. China is a threat to life as we know it in the United States of America. And so America is going to have to stand up and be responsible on those fronts. And I will quote Ronald Reagan. He said, "You will have peace through strength." And I believe that as long as we continue to field the best and most capable military on the planet, as long as we're able to match them in technology and in weapons platforms, I think we can better ensure a more peaceful world, because deterrence is what we all hope to see happen where conflict is possible. And we got time for maybe one more call. I want to go to Steve from Fort Smith. Can you weigh in tonight, Steve?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I appreciate the call. And I'm a retired Navy veteran. I was in from 78 to 98. But my questions were, the drones and the East Coast, border security, and also I'm having a hard time getting my Part B Social Security to keep my TRICARE Prime going on.
Okay, now are you on TRICARE Prime or TRICARE for Life?
TRICARE Prime. I think I need the Medicare Part A and B for TRICARE for Life.
Yeah, So I can speak to that because I'm unimpacted by it as well. Because of a quirk in the law, in order to keep TRICARE, you have to pay your Part B premium. And that doesn't seem terribly fair, but it's the law. These are retired people from the military, those of you that are not military people on this call tonight, in order to be able to to benefit from your TRICARE program, which is what you earn through your military service, you have to pay your Part B premium. So if you are eligible for Medicare, then you have to pay that Part B premium. If you're not taking your Medicare, if you're not taking your Social Security, but you're eligible for Medicare, then you have to write that check. If not, it just comes out of your Social Security check. I know that firsthand. But that's a function of law right now. And that Part B premium is based on income. So there's a base amount that you have to pay if you're just low income. But if you make more money, then you have to pay what they call the IRMA, and that's a higher premium for Part B because of additional income. And it's an IRMA, and I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it's some enhancement of your premium. Like right now, Steve, and I don't mind telling you, my Part B premium is nearly $500 a month. That's what I have to pay in order to keep my TRICARE. Now, if I didn't care about TRICARE, I wouldn't worry about it. But I have to do that. So anyway, all right. So the last part of your question was what?
East Coast and border security.
Okay. Well, we've talked already about border security. I'm a big believer that we've got to do something to stem the illegal crossings, not just because it's wrong, but, I mean, we've got a lot of other things happening down there. Fentanyl's crossing that border at alarming rates. There are violent extremists that are coming across, terrorists that are coming across. There's a lot of, man, I'll tell you what, I've had my eyes open to this human trafficking phenomenon. I didn't know it was that bad, but we've got a lot of issues regarding human trafficking. And quite frankly, the problem stems from the fact that I don't think Mexico is doing us any favors down there on that border by holding up their end of the bargain. Those borders anymore are dominated by the cartels. And that's a big money. That's billions and billions of dollars that these cartels are making by selling their influence, if you will, down there along that border. Border security is going to happen under the next administration. It can't happen soon enough to suit me. All right, so it's almost 8 o'clock in Arkansas, 9 o'clock in Washington, D.C., and I just want to tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to spend some time with you guys here tonight. If we didn't get you tonight, please stay on the call, and you can leave a message. We always count it an honor and a privilege to spend this kind of time with the people that we represent. Watch our social media at rep_Steve Womack or sign up for our newsletter, that's *6, or you can go to our website, womack.house.gov, and stay up to date. Again, my office number in Rogers for people that have casework that they need to start with is 479-464-0446. If you ever need assistance, you can send us an email or contact us, and we'll be more than happy to help your case. As a reminder, stay on the line after the call to leave a message. I hope that each and every one of you have a safe and enjoyable Christmas and a very, very happy New Year. And once again, thank you for the great honor of serving one of America's premier districts, Northwest Arkansas and the River Valley, Arkansas 3. Thank you so much. You guys have a terrific evening. Good night.